Welcome to Tax Breaks, a podcast by the Federation of Tax Administrators, where we delve into current subjects and their relevance to the realm of tax administration. Each episode of the podcast features conversations with esteemed professionals from government, academia, and the private sector, and our guests generously share their wealth of knowledge and unique perspectives, providing invaluable insights and expertise to our listeners. I'm Ryan Minnick, FTA's Chief Operating Officer, and this episode I'm joined by Professor Robbie Ratan, who is a professor at both Michigan State University and Stanford, and he's also the founder of the Sparty Lab, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. Professor Ratan's research sits at the intersection of human interaction and technology, so everything from deepfakes, psychology, artificial intelligence, and more are fair game for this conversation. And so without further ado, here's my chat with Professor Robbie Ratan. This week, we're joined by Professor Robbie Ratan, Michigan State University and Stanford University. Professor Ratan has spoken at a couple FTA conferences. Actually, we're in between two as we record the podcast. So he just spoke at our annual meeting a few weeks back in Long Beach, California. And he'll be speaking at our technology conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in just a few short days. So welcome, Professor Ratan. Really excited to have you join Tax Breaks.
It's my pleasure to be here, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me. And feel free to call me Robbie.
Oh, of course. So Robbie, the first thing we like to do for our listeners, you know, our listeners are pretty diverse. We've got tax preparers, tax practitioners, people who are in tax administration, and occasionally the random person who just clicks on us in Apple Podcasts and wants to know more about how, you know, government and innovation can be used in the same sentence. So for everybody's benefit, like, could you share, I think your background's super fascinating because you not only teach at two universities virtually, which is akin to the nature of your work, but you also kind of came into this field a little obliquely. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always found the intersection of people and technology fascinating. And so as an undergrad, my major was called Science, Technology, and Society, which some people may have heard of, but most haven't. It's an interdisciplinary major where students learn about how those three things, science, technology, and society, are mutually influential. It's not just that technology determines what people do, or that science determines what technologies get developed, but also, you know, people determine which science we should be doing and which technologies and how to develop them. And so so that area of study was kind of like a high level entrance into what eventually became my focus as a graduate student, looking at human-computer interaction, so the psychology of how people use technology, and in particular, media technology. I come from the field of communication, and so we look at how people communicate through technology and with technology. How do we communicate through, meaning using computers, social media, video games, avatars to talk to other people or go to class or do our work? And how do we communicate with technology? How do I talk to my AI agent or simply my voice interface on my computer, Siri, or simply which buttons do I click, right? So there are many ways we can think about both of those topics. And the name of the kind of subfield related to all of these things that I ended up in is called media psychology. So we're looking at media technologies and we're using theories and understandings from psychology, from the way that people relate to each other, the way that people are psychologically perceiving themselves, what influences perceptions of the self. These are all ideas that come out of psychology, but we're applying it to these contexts of media use, of communicating through and communicating with technology. And so I discovered this concept of the metaverse while I was doing media psychology. It actually inspired me to graduate studies. I read the book Snow Crash, written by Neal Stephenson in 1992. That book coined the term metaverse, and it also popularized the term avatar. And around the same time, I read an article from one of my mentors, Jeremy Balanson at Stanford, a prominent VR scholar, and in that article, he argued that science fiction gives us a great roadmap to the future of our research. on these technologies in media psychology or the study of communication and technology. And I was struck by this idea that, wow, this science fiction book about this future metaverse thing could actually require real research. We need to think about virtual reality and communicating through avatars. And I was doing this in the year 2005, and it seemed far off. The VR headsets we were using in the lab were hundreds of thousands of dollars. But the idea that one day they would be consumer products, you know, accessible to the masses, was fascinating and exciting to me. And so then I dedicated the rest of my academic career, my whole career, I'm an academic, to studying how people integrate their daily activities, their of course leisure activities, but also meaningful activities such as school and work and health related activities into their technology use, or the other way around. How does technology influence those meaningful activities, and how can we think about the outcomes of video games and virtual world use in a way that is just is not just relegated to those media environments, but how do they really matter in our lives? And so I started teaching in VR in 2022, but I was working up to that, teaching with avatars and other kind of novel media technologies from the first year I started teaching as an undergrad professor. And so now I'm kind of living that reality. All of my students have VR headsets. I live in California. My students are here in Michigan. I'm in Michigan at this moment. We meet multiple times a week in VR. We're mediated by avatars. We talk about the psychology of communicating through avatars. We do research. My research students and I in my lab study how people meet in these spaces and interact through avatars, and how we can design these spaces to improve equity as an outcome, or improve well-being, or reduce Zoom fatigue, think about gender differences, race differences, as outcomes of these technologies and the design of facets of these technologies. So that's kind of the ground on which I'm standing as I look at your world, Ryan, the world of tax, the world of establishing trust with your customers and deepfakes. And so hopefully I can provide a valuable perspective to you and your community.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to need like 6 podcast episodes to walk through all the things that just popped into my head as you were talking. So I always joke, tax administration is that really important work that no one really knows happens, right? It's between the thing everybody pays attention to, which is tax policy, and the thing everybody hates to do, which is pay taxes. And the administration is just this tremendous amount of work to make sure to, you know, fairness, equity, all of the implementations and policy writings and decisions that have to go into it. But it's a really critical kind of hidden work that's just not super visible. And it's really interesting to me that in the same way, a lot of your work is this, you've been infrastructurally working on all of these big questions from, you know, from the early 2000s to now about, okay, science fiction shows us potential for the future, which is a sentiment that I love. Actually, the Nolans, who were the producers and writers for Westworld on HBO, they were doing a panel and they were asked why they think science fiction is such an important genre. And they said that science fiction is our opportunity to not only look to the future to see what's possible, but to also warn ourselves, if we don't do it responsibly, what could happen. And no spoilers for Westworld for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, but highly encourage people to watch it. And in the same way, I think this is really, it's really interesting. Like, you took from that this and saw the academic opportunity to infrastructurally understand all of these engagement factors, because that to me is the kind of the critical component of all of this, right? Like, that's the, if we don't understand the psychology of how people interface with computers and how we do what we do, we're not going to engage as much. And I think about a good example. I have an early generation Oculus device, VR, so in your wheelhouse. Super interesting, great, fun to kind of, you know, play Beat Saber or whatever in. But then, you know, never really put it on. The first thing I thought was, I would never work in this. Like, this is crazy. Like, it's not the fidelity's not right. The motion's just okay. Like, no, there's no nausea. There's no, none of that, but just isn't super relevant. Didn't interface with me in the way that I would expect. Fast forward to the awesome demo that you gave me in Long Beach of the Apple Vision Pro, where, you know, you triggered a demo, all of a sudden a window opened up in front of me in the intersection of augmented reality and virtual reality. a dinosaur leans out and I'm sitting here in the middle of a conference room, like petting a dinosaur and completely immersed in that world. If it weren't for all of the advances researchers like you were doing, like that would not be nearly as engaging. And I walked away from that thinking, you know, second or third gen of this product, when it becomes slightly more affordable for the average, you know, nonprofit person, I could see myself working in that. Like I wasn't fatigued. I could see the world around me. I could see that, you know, you'd get larger displays or larger opportunities to engage. So this is really cool stuff. And I know that we'll, you know, at some point we'll turn our attention talking about maybe the dark side of psychology and how we interact. But I think I'm so, to increase my jealousy, of course, you had to pull out the Vision Pro. For those of you who are listening and not watching the podcast, Professor Rattan has officially the best official research gear. I won't call them toys, but the best gear in research right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Totally it was toys.
Super awesome. So I just think this is such so applicable. And I'll tie it back to government briefly and kind of ask you my next question. So, you know, in government, obviously, technology modernization is always a big topic. And we usually look at it in the context of our systems, right? We have these giant mainframe systems. Most of them in government, they were commissioned in the 60s and 70s, some of them in the 80s. They're big old lumbering pieces of equipment that are all being phased out. Regrettably, I have to say in 2024, they're all still being phased out. But we're moving towards more modern infrastructure to support the functional software that we use. But there's also this new trend that's popped up that's always been there, but really came to a point during the pandemic and now has continued to accelerate. And that's customer experience and employee engagement and collaboration and hybrid work. And across that spectrum, you know, we find ourselves in similar places to the private sector. So government doesn't always innovate or always adopt technologies as fast as the private sector does for a lot of legitimate reasons. Sometimes it's budget, but often it's because we have to ensure things like data security and privacy and whatever else. But we're accelerating that because citizens, taxpayers, expect equal engagement. The internet's the leveling playing field. Consumers and taxpayers and constituents expect the same experience from their governments online that they expect from third party, you know, tech companies or platforms or universities. And so as I look at the innovation happening in customer experience and how in the future we're going to be engaging with more and more people virtually, more people in rural areas, perhaps as connectivity gets better, more people who are, you know, maybe just even busy people who don't have time to go down to a physical office and meet with somebody over a small issue. And I won't even layer in, you know, anything artificial intelligence yet. It's just purely that engagement. So let's talk about the dark side of it first, because I think the light side is far more happy. Dark side, of course, is this topic of deepfakes. Now, I have to tell all of our listeners, I was deepfaked at the annual meeting. Professor Rattan Robbie got on stage, and first thing he did was show a kind of a low fidelity classroom, but popped up as Ryan the avatar. And at that stage, you know, the point was very abstract, but it was with higher fidelity software and with, you know, voice modulation and all these other things, and with a knowledge of me that you could either purchase from the dark web or, you know, just go listen to a few podcasts and read a few posts on LinkedIn, you could potentially impersonate me to a believable level to engage with someone for criminal purposes. So like I said, we'll talk about the positive part about that later, but like this deepfake issue, I think, is going to take root, especially in areas of high risk, like engagement with taxpayers or engagement with, you know, the DMVs engaging with people, because you have to be certain the person you're talking to is who they say they are. And identity verification is one of those things that humans naturally do when we're in person together. But you actually have a lot of research that talks about how that identity, that trust between two people when they're talking is actually built and how technology can influence that. So I guess my question for you is, how should we be looking at the dark side of deepfakes? Is this all doom and gloom? Are we all just going to get, you know, pounded with deepfakes in our call centers and our video meetings? Or is there a far more kind of pragmatic approach that, you know, technology is going to kind of help mitigate that risk as it matures?
That's the question. And I guess when we imagine these new technologies in the future, we often romanticize and villainize them simultaneously. Westworld's a great example, right? I believe it is meant to be a cautionary tale in many ways, and that's you know, maybe the goal that they had in producing it, you know, warn us of where things could go wrong. There are, of course, science fiction films that romanticize and get us excited about these new technologies. Certainly, the companies making them romanticize them and frame them as like, okay, this will finally fix your life, right? This will finally fix the problems you've had as a human. And dark side, light side, I'm skeptical of both, right? I don't think technology can make us, it can't solve our problems, and it probably won't destroy the world until it does. But in terms of deepfakes, the technology is getting easier. It's a cat and mouse game. It's a game of catch up, like with so many technologies. When we are introduced with a new form of interaction, especially with something that's human-like, or realistic, but not actually non-mediated, we initially treat it as very real. So one of the famous anecdotes, I don't know if it's actually true, is one of the first moving pictures, I think it was the Lumiere brothers, filmed a train coming into a station, and then they would do these showings, and people would watch, you know, this very grainy black and white film of a train coming into the station, and supposedly people would scream and run out of the theater, or at least one person did it once, and who knows, were they joking or not? But we've all experienced a new media technology and thought, wow, that's really immersive. Like, wow, that 4K television is really immersive. Or, wow, that VR headset, I feel like I'm really there. Or, no, it's this headset. Or, no, it's this next headset, right? And then we get used to it. We have this, like, excellent ability due to brain plasticity, due to kind of what it means to evolve as a human in the natural world. We have this great ability to treat the novel as commonplace once we've been exposed to it a few times. And that applies also to social scripts. So you might think of the anecdote of grandma and grandpa talking to Siri as if it's really a person. And we, you know, we kind of chuckle at that, like, oh, we'd never do that. But you will when you're grandma and grandpa and Siri is smarter than GPT is today. You'll be amazed. You'll really experience that helper robot as a real being, right? This is just what we do. Psychologically, the phenomenon that I'm referring to is called the media equation, which basically says that when we have a social, psychological pattern of interaction with other people, if we replace half of the equation, if we replace one of the people in this interpersonal interaction with a technology, but it still seems like it's interacting as if it's a person, the rule applies. So if you're told you're on the same team as someone else, you'll like them more, you'll, you know, want to hang out with them longer, you'll rate them better. Same thing with a computer. If you're told this computer is on your team, even if it's just text on a screen, you'll rate the computer as faster and more accurate, and you'll like it more. If a computer, just text on a screen, compliments you and tells you you're great, you're more likely to assess it positively. This has been established in multiple studies. But those studies happened in the 90s. Today, text on a screen doesn't have as strong an effect. The technologies of the day, right? Verbal GPT, which I use on my phone all the time, really does have an effect on me. I feel like I'm talking to a person. But the more I use it, the more I get used to it. So here's my point. With deep fakes, it's not about this specific technology or that one. When I put on my virtual Ryan Minnick in Engage VR through a Meta Quest 3, it didn't seem super high fidelity to you because you're experienced with these technologies. But it's amazing in some ways that I could, in real time, embody something that looked kind of like you. And for people who were unfamiliar with that, they would think like, wow. Like when people put on these headsets, they say like, wow, I'm really there. And the next phase of the technology will be more persuasive until it's not. And so the goal here is to help people recognize not which specific technology will be used to deepfake in your customers, your tax professionals, your, you know, intermediaries, your government representatives. It's not about the specific technology. It's about recognizing the kind of fundamental theories of communication, that media equation idea, that recognition, like, oh, this thing seems human-like, and I'm very likely to respond to it as if it's really a human, and I know that because I understand this theory, and I'm not thinking about the technology, I'm thinking about the theory, then I'm more likely to have like a robust kind of protection against that type of trickery. So in the same way as like I might be able to recognize email fraud because that doesn't really seem like a Nigerian prince offering me millions of dollars in a transfer. I can do that through email super easily because I'm used to it. But the same theory applies in these new media contexts. It's just, you know, a little bit more realistic.
Interesting. You know, I find that, you know, so my background's technology systems, not the psychology side that you work on. And so I find that things like risk and fraud are always measured on a gradient, right? Like the higher effort fraud require, you know, is obviously a riskier type of fraud, but it's also lower volume because it's higher effort. The question is, you know, can you ever automate or can you ever execute really advanced fraud with data at scale? And that's when it becomes a riskier and harder to mitigate issue for government agencies, really for anybody. I mean, I think this is a kind of a universal ratio. And so for deepfakes, I think what always strikes me about it, and this is really interesting, your point about, you know, it is, of course, across all classes of technology. I mean, you're always going to have, at the moment technology comes out, it is utilized in some way by criminals to do something. They're going to experiment with it just like we're going to experiment with it to make our lives easier. You know, being a criminal is a job. It's not a great job. I don't encourage people to take it. But the first thing I always tell people when I'm on stage talking about fraud is right now, somewhere else in the world, there's people talking about the exact opposite of what we're talking about. So if I'm doing a session at a conference or we're having a podcast about how you mitigate fraud, there's somewhere else, there's a conference session and a podcast about how you commit it. So it's always going to be this ever-evolving thing, for at least for deepfakes. I mean, the part that I think comforts me a little bit is the higher the fidelity, the harder the effort. It's not impossible to do, but it's super targeted, right? So it's not like somebody's going to go out and automate deepfakes for 5,000 taxpayers and all of a sudden hit a call center and do whatever. Are we getting there with technology? Perhaps, but that's a tremendous amount of data you have to collate and put in one place and automate in order to execute something at that scale. I think it's far more likely we're going to encounter it on a smaller scale, highly targeted individuals. I think about, you know, as much as it's kind of loosely related, you know, cell phone account takeovers. Those were, you know, a really easy way to bypass two-factor authentication back when we relied on SMS authentication. And so it was really effective, but it was really targeted. You had to know somebody's phone number. You had to really know a good amount of information about them. You had to really want to get to that person specifically. You know, there were very few schemes where that was automated just for the sake of getting somebody. So hopefully, you know, as technologies mature, we'll continue to do, you know, the people on the good side will continue to do their work to mitigate the effects of what people on the criminal side are doing. But that being said, you kind of started touching on it, the kind of the glorified version, right? And I like your point. I think that's super accurate. We always do that with technology. New things come out and here's all the ways it could be awful and here's all the ways that it's perfect. And let's talk more about that side of things. How are you seeing people use these technologies today? Are we starting to see some of the things in your research truly play out? Obviously in the classroom they are, because you've been teaching that way. And you know, I'm sure that the education experience, I mean, you've been doing it for several years now, the fidelity's got to be there, because otherwise it would have been an experiment and you'd be doing something else now. But how are we seeing the private sector start to adopt this? I mean, you see little things like, you know, Google Glass in manufacturing, or a couple people buying large units of Apple Vision Pro to put with a certain business unit to try our designers. You know, are we seeing scale of these technologies being adopted at the moment?
We are. I think the place where we're seeing the most scale is in training. And again, my mentor, Jeremy Bailenson, has a framework, the DICE framework, meaning you should only use VR for things that are, in this DICE acronym, dangerous, impossible, counterproductive, or expensive. So you can, and if you can hit multiple letters in the acronym, all the better. So if you want to train, you know, active shooter response, or angry customer response, or medical training for distributed students around the world, there are many different training scenarios that are happening at scale in big companies, companies whose names you would recognize, who you've probably shopped at or banked at, and they are training their workforce using these technologies, and it's saving them a lot of money. It's keeping their workforce safe, their organization kind of reducing liability. And so you can imagine that that will continue to grow as the technology and the ability to kind of create these training scenarios becomes easier. AI will be a big part of that. You know, create a burning building with this many windows and this many things. And right now that would take hundreds of hours maybe to build from the ground up, maybe a little bit less if you were to use some existing systems. But with AI, you know, imagine an hour of the same way you might craft through GPT with text the document you want for your annual review or whatever it is. You'll be able to do that, but with virtual worlds around you. So training's a big one. In terms of the deepfake type of technology, not on the VR side, we're starting to see it, right? We use our self-presentation for social influence all the time. On Zoom, I always push my touch-up appearance slider just enough so I feel a little less concerned, a little less self-aware, self-conscious. And that's the type of technology that we will continue to see in the VR context, in the video conferencing context. We can think of those kind of as a spectrum of immersion in the technologies of meeting with other people. And that is being used for good because in the research we're doing, we're finding there are differences in Zoom fatigue, for example, between men and women. And we know that that's partially caused by double standards of self-presentation in the workforce or in our societies. So these societal norms are leading to a disparity, which has nothing to do with how well you're doing at work, how capable or confident or competent you are. It just has to do with your gender and how you look. And that doesn't seem fair, but also more, well, not necessarily more importantly, but also importantly, if you don't care about fairness and equity, is it's not efficient, right? It's not efficient for your workforce or your organization to have this type of inequity. And so avatars or you know, deep faking yourself, we wouldn't really call it that, but having control over your impression management in these social encounters in the workplace is very important for the outcomes, your bottom line, as well as, you know, the well-being of your workforce. And so hopefully organizations start to care about that. That's research that one of my advisees, Chan Lim, is leading right now as part of her dissertation out of one of our studies that's funded by the National Science Foundation about equity in virtual meetings in the workplace. And so we're seeing the good side. We're seeing the potential for the good side. It's still early in the development of many of these technologies, but I'm quite optimistic. It does start to get weird, though. At what point does the good side become the bad side? Like if I say I want to always smile at my boss and nod, like turn on sycophant, you know, automation, and or I want to make myself more attractive to this dating partner, or I want to, you know, be cool with my friends, right? Like at some level, we do this naturally. We intentionally manage the impressions that we make with other people, and there's a long history of literature theory built in the field of communication and psychology about this phenomenon. But at what point does it feel disingenuous to just click a button and have technology do it for you? Is that fair? Is that unfair? I mean, some people are better at it than others. The extroverts in the room will be like, oh yeah, that's unfair, I just do it. But the introverts might be like, yeah, it takes me a lot of effort to go into a room full of people and put on, you know, my party self. I mean, it takes all of us effort, but for some of us, it's easier than others. And so maybe it is fair to be able to do that. But then does that mean it's not dishonest? At what point does it become uncomfortable? Will society generally change our norms around what is dishonest in self-presentation in these social contexts? These are largely unknown questions, but pretty exciting, I think, and, you know, relevant to taxes in your world, because like most of these organizations, you interact with people in a way that matters, that where trust matters. And so it's important at the organizational level to think about the norms that you want to prescribe and the values that you want to uphold.
Well, it's interesting, and also I have a feeling that, you know, that there's an inflection point in there as well that relates back to what you were talking about earlier, which is that we get used to things, right? So right now, you know, I have to imagine, I always find, you know, like the Zoom enhancements are a really good example, right? Like for the exact opposite logic, I always turn mine down because I'd rather look better in person than people see me on camera. Like, you know, show like that way when they meet me in person, like, wow, you look better than you do virtually.
And do I'm they
like,
tell you that?
No, no one's ever said it, but I have to think that they think it. I mean, that's
I'm gonna try to remember to say it.
Yeah. The logic of an extrovert, right? It's like, okay, I don't want people to see me in person and then think, wow, I'd rather be talking to them, you know, in Zoom. But you see some of those tools, and when they were new, I mean, even something as simple as blurring out your background, right? I mean, so the camera I'm using right now has like a bokeh effect on it. So it's not, you know, you can still see that I'm in my office. You know, it definitely appears real. There's no weird cutting around my head, so I'm not using a virtual background. But I remember when virtual backgrounds and blurring your background first started rolling out, that was bothersome for a lot of people. There were questions within, you know, government organizations and other, like, do we roll out a background for everybody? Is it weird not seeing where someone is? What if they're in a coffee shop? What if that's a security risk? Do we really need to know where they are? All these things. And ultimately, we got used to them. So now, you know, we're just happy if people turn their cameras on, let alone what their background looks like. But I remember that being a really big jarring change, because prior to that virtual functionality, prior to computers getting good enough to show virtual backgrounds and not make it look all, you know, pixely and jump you around, you just joined a camera from wherever you were. You didn't have a blurred background. You just kind of showed up. You were, you know, in your dining room, or you're in your office, or you're at work. And that was just the way that it was. And so I almost wonder, like, some of these technologies, I guess Microsoft must have run into some of the same things that you noticed in your research, because I remember, was it 4 or 5? It might have been pre-pandemic, when they were rolling out updates to their webcam software. And they're like, hey, we have this really cool webcam thing. Like, when you're using a laptop and you're in a video call, you're always staring at your screen. So you're not looking at the person you're talking to. So we're going to put this little software trick in Surface devices that's going to cause, you know, your eyes to look at the camera. And I never really heard much of it ever again. Like, it was like, I saw it in
beta. They did that? Did they? I'm wondering if it functioned, because that's something we've talked about in the field for a long time. You know, the person who coined the term virtual reality, Jaron Lanier, wrote about that in the early 2000s, I think, and how it makes video conferencing so unnatural. But I've never actually seen a good software fix for it. So I'd love to look that up now.
It was one of their build hardware events, you know, a few years back. And, you know, no hard feelings at Microsoft. I just thought it was interesting when they rolled it out. And then just over time, never really saw it happen, because the first thought that I had when they announced it, which is actually a point I think you made on stage at Annual, which is my first thought was, well, that's creepy. Like, I don't necessarily want eye contact all the time with the person I'm talking to. But, you know, I kind of get the idea. It is weird sometimes when we're in Zoom and everybody's looking at their screen and you don't know what people are looking at. But it just was a very, obviously, a solution born in technology, made it to the point of being announced. Likely, maybe the software didn't work. Maybe the psychology of the software working was just too freaky for people in the beta group, and so they'd ended up not rolling it out. Maybe they've rolled it out in a hybrid format, and now it's just doing something subtle in the background and none of us know about it. Who knows? But really interesting to me that this, like, the intersection of your work and some of these more basic things that we use today is, you know, eye contact and body language and how all of that influences what we do and how, you know, to your point, genuineness and authenticity and trust. So I feel like this is one of those areas where we have to keep watching this space. I mean, we fundamentally engage differently than we did 4 years ago, due to massive acceleration associated with the global pandemic. So bad thing that led to a massive acceleration of a few good things. Now it feels like we're kind of Mad Maxing our way through technology now. Like, we didn't slow down. Like, some people return to work, some people are hybrid. We're doing a lot more virtual engagement. I mean, we're recording this podcast virtually. We're not slowing down. So I have to assume these technologies are going to become more and more important, which is why we were so grateful to have you join us and present your research, and why we're excited to stay in touch and continue to engage with you and your teams, because this is an opportunity, I think. I'm, you know, Pollyanna about technology all the time. The opportunity for government to kind of inject our concerns into something early on, because like I said, data security, data privacy, identity verification, those are all things that we care about tremendously. And when we're part of that understanding that research as it's happening, as products come out, my hope is that we can help people bridge that gap between something new and something workable. I mean, Apple Vision Pro is a really great example. I don't know of a revenue agency who's trying them out, but I have to imagine there's a government agency somewhere who's utilizing them in some way to think about what the future of either that employee's experience or productivity or what their engagement with, a constituent looks like. And we should all be looking forward. The future is really exciting until it's scary, so.
Exciting and scary often go hand in hand. So, yeah, I think I like your sentiment here, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be part of the conversation in this realm where, like you said, a lot of work happens that's not appreciated, in your latest sitcom or thriller or drama, right? Like, people don't write stories about our work. But to me, it's fascinating. To me, I love my job because every day I get to think about something I find really interesting. And those things change somewhat on a maybe not daily, but monthly or annual basis. And there's a freedom in my career as a professor. I get to follow those interests. But at the same time, I'm following a trajectory that is consistent from with where I started. I'm going through boxes in my from my flooded basement recently, and luckily this box wasn't flooded. I found my college application, and I found the what I'd written about when I was after I'd been accepted, and I was, proposing majors, and I said I was interested in computer science and psychology, and I studied not that as an undergrad, but I ended up back there, and right? I'm really interested in how people and technology intersect, as I said. And so, yeah, feel free to reach out, not just Ryan, but anyone who's listening. If you have questions about how these technologies, avatars or virtual reality, deep fakes, etc., how they affect your work, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm always happy to have a chat, especially if you mention that you heard the podcast and you're connected with FTA or otherwise, or you just listened because you love taxes. Happy to respond.
Well, I appreciate that. I know our listeners do. I guess my last question for you is anything you're working on or got going on that you want to, promote or talk about before we wrap up?
If you're interested in my world, check out my lab website, Sparti.org, SPARTIE.org. That's the lab that I run at Michigan State University. And so, we're always looking for partners, we're always looking for funders, people who want to get involved and donate money to the university to do a project relating to your interests, buy some VR headsets for students. That's the daily work that we do.
Well, we'll be sure to check out Sparty.org. And, I'm sure this is not the last time we'll be chatting, maybe after you finish your book, or maybe when the next great thing in digital engagement and technology comes along, we can talk through the psychological effects. So thank you so much for taking some time to chat with myself and all of our Tax Breaks listeners. And I look forward to seeing you on stage in a couple weeks. By the time this comes out, I think you will have already presented. So hopefully, if you're listening to this, you got to see Robbie on stage. And if not, we look forward to more work with Robbie in the future and his teams. Thanks so much.